thanks for my life, he said. Any time, my friend. She reached up and held his face in her hands. But don't keep me waiting like that again. I nearly went crazy. All I could think of was that someone had recognized you, that something terrible had happened. You forget. No one knows what I look like. Don't count on that. It's not true. There were four men in the Stepdeckstrasse, including that bastard in the Gizonki. They're alive, Jason. They saw you. Not really. They saw a dark-haired man with bandages on his neck and head who walked with a limp. Only two were near me. The man on the second floor and that pig in the Gison. The first won't be leaving Zurich for a while. He can't walk and he hasn't much of a hand left. The second had the beam of the flashlight in his eyes. It wasn't in mine. She released him, frowning, her alert mind questioning. You can't be sure. They were there. They did see you. Change your hair. You change your face. Geoffrey Washburn, Ile de Pointe Noire. I repeat, they saw a dark-haired man in shadows. How good are you with a weak solution of peroxide? I've never used it. Then I'll find a shop in the morning. The Montparnasse is the place for it. Blondes have more fun, isn't that what they say? She studied his face. I'm trying to imagine what you'll look like. Different. Not much, but enough. You may be right. I hope to God you are. She kissed his cheek. A prelude to discussion. Now, tell me what happened. Where did you go? What did you learn about that incident 6 months ago? It wasn't 6 months ago, and because it wasn't, I couldn't have killed him. He told her everything, save for the few brief moments when he thought he would never see her again. He did not have to. She said it for him. If that date hadn't been so clear in your mind. You wouldn't have come to me, would you? He shook his head. Probably not. I knew it. I felt it. For a minute, while I was walking from the cafe to the museum steps, I could hardly breathe. It was as though I was suffocating. Can you believe that? I don't want to. Neither do I. But it happened. They were sitting, she on the bed, he in the single armchair close by. He reached for her hand. I'm still not sure I should be here. I knew that man. I saw his face. I was in Marseille 48 hours before he was killed. But you didn't kill him. Then why was I there? Why do people think I did? Christ, it's insane! He sprang up from the chair, pain back in his eyes. But then I forgot. I'm not sane, am I? Because I've forgotten. Years. A lifetime. Marie spoke matter-of-factly, no compassion in her voice. The answers will come to you. From one source or another. Finally from yourself. That may not be possible. Washburn said it was like blocks rearranged. Different tunnels. Different windows. Jason walked to the window, bracing himself on the sill, looking down on the lights of Montparnasse. The views aren't the same. They never will be. Somewhere out there are people I know, who know me. A couple of thousand miles away are other people I care about and don't care about. Or, oh God, maybe a wife and children. I don't know. I keep spinning around in the wind, turning over and over, and I can't get down to the ground. Every time I try, I get thrown back up again. Into the sky? Asked Marie. Yes. You've jumped from a plane, she said, making a statement. Bourne turned. I never told you that. You talked about it in your sleep the other night. You were sweating. Your face was flushed and hot, and I had to wipe it with a towel. Why didn't you say anything?
I did, in a way.
I asked you if you were a pilot, or if flying bothered you, especially at night. I didn't know what you were talking about. Why didn't you press me?
I was afraid to. You were very close to hysterics, and I'm not trained in things like that.
I can help you try to remember, but I can't deal with your unconscious. I don't think anyone should but a doctor.
A doctor? I was with a doctor for damn near 6 months.
From what you've said about him, I think another opinion is called for.
I don't, he replied, confused by his own anger.
Why not?
Marie got up from the bed.
You need help, my darling. A psychiatrist might...
No! He shouted in spite of himself, furious with himself. I won't do that. I can't.
Please, tell me why,
she asked calmly, standing in front of him.
I can't do it. Just tell me why, that's all.
Bourne stared at her, then turned and looked out the window again, his hands on the sill again.
Because I'm afraid.
Someone lied, and I was grateful for that more than I can tell you. But suppose there aren't any more lies. Suppose the rest is true. What do I do then?
Are you saying you don't want to find out?
Not that way. He stood up and leaned against the window frame, his eyes still on the lights below.
Try to understand me, he said.
I have to know certain things, enough to make a decision, but maybe not everything. A part of me has to be able to walk away, disappear. I have to be able to say to myself, what was isn't any longer, and there's a possibility that it never was because I have no memory of it. What a person can't remember didn't exist.
For him.
He turned back to her. What I'm trying to tell you is that maybe it's better this way.
You want evidence, but not proof. Is that what you're saying?
I want arrows pointing in one direction or the other, telling me whether to run or not to run.
Telling you. What about us?
That'll come with the arrows, won't it? You know that.
Then let's find them,
she replied. Be careful. You may not be able to live with what's out there.
I mean that. I can live with you. And I mean that.
She reached up and touched his face.
Come on. It's barely 5 o'clock in Ontario, and I can still reach Peter at the office. He can start the Treadstone search, and give us the name of someone here at the embassy who can help us if we need him.
You're going to tell Peter you're in Paris?
He'll know it anyway from the operator, but the call won't be traceable to this hotel. And don't worry, I'll keep everything in-house, even casual. I came to Paris for a few days because my relatives in Lyon are simply too dull. He'll accept that.
Would he know someone at the embassy here?
Peter makes it a point to know someone everywhere. It's one of his more useful but less attractive traits.
Sounds like he will. Bourne got their coats. After your call, we'll have dinner. I think we could both use a drink.
Let's go past the bag on Rue Madeleine. I want to see something.
What can you see at night?
A telephone booth.
I hope there's one nearby. There was. Diagonally across the street from the entrance. The tall, blonde man wearing tortoiseshell glasses checked his watch under the afternoon sun on the Rue Madeleine. The pavements were crowded, the traffic in the street unreasonable, as most traffic was in Paris. He entered the telephone booth and untangled the telephone, which had been hanging free of its cradle. The line nodded. It was a courteous sign to the next would-be user that the phone was out of commission. It reduced the chance that the booth would be occupied. It had worked. He glanced at his watch again. The time span had begun. Marie inside the bank. She would call within the next few minutes. He took several coins from his pocket, put them on the ledge, and leaned against the glass panel, his eyes on the bank across the street. A cloud diminished the sunlight, and he could see his reflection in the glass. He approved of what he saw, recalling the startled reaction of a hairdresser in Montparnasse who had sequestered him in a curtained booth while performing the blonde transformation. The cloud passed, the sunlight returned, and the telephone rang.
"It's you?"
asked Marie Saint-Jacques.
"It's me," said Bourne. "Make sure you get the name and the location of the office, and rough up your French. Mispronounce a few words so he knows you're American. Tell him you're not used to the telephones in Paris. Then do everything in sequence. I'll call you back in exactly 5 minutes."
Clock's on.
"What?"
"Nothing. I mean, let's go."
"All right. The clock is on. Good luck."
"Thanks." Jason depressed the lever, released it, and dialed the number he had memorized.
"Le Banque de Valois. Bonjour."
"I need assistance," said Bourne, continuing with the approximate words Marie had told him to use. "I recently transferred sizable funds from Switzerland on a pouch courier basis. I'd like to know if they've cleared."
"That would be our Foreign Services Department, sir. I'll connect you."
A click, then another female voice.
"Foreign Services?"
Jason repeated his request.
"May I have your name, please?"
"I'd prefer speaking with an officer of the bank before giving it." There was a pause on the line.
"Very well, sir. I'll switch you to the office of Vice President Damacourt."
Monsieur Damacourt's secretary was less accommodating. The bank officer's screening process activated, as Marie had predicted. Sir Bourne once more used Marie's words. "I'm referring to a transfer from Zurich, from the Gemeinschaft Bank on the Bahnhofstrasse, and I'm talking in the area of 7 figures. Monsieur Damacourt, if you please, I have very little time." It was not a secretary's place to be the cause of further delay. A perplexed first vice president got on the line.
"May I help you?"
"Are you Damacourt?" asked Jason.
"I am Antoine Damacourt, yes. And who, may I ask, is calling?"
"Good. I should have been given your name in Zurich." "I'll make certain next time, certainly," said Bourne, the redundancy intended, his accent American.
"I beg your pardon. Would you be more comfortable speaking English, monsieur?"
"Yes," replied Jason, doing so. "I'm having enough trouble with this damn phone." He looked at his watch. He had less than 2 minutes. "My name's Bourne, Jason Bourne, and 8 days ago I transferred 4.5 million francs from the Gemeinschaft Bank in Zurich. They assured me the transaction would be confidential."
"All transactions are confidential, sir."
"Fine, good. What I want to know is, has everything cleared?"
"I should explain," continued the bank officer, "that confidentiality excludes blanket confirmations of such transactions to unknown parties over the telephone."
Marie had been right, the logic of her trap clearer to Jason. "I would hope so. But as I told your secretary, I'm in a hurry. I'm leaving Paris in a couple of hours and I have to put everything in order."
"Then I suggest you come to the bank."
"I know that," said Bourne, satisfied that the conversation was going precisely the way Marie foresaw it. "I just wanted everything ready when I got there. Where's your office?"
"On the main floor, monsieur. At the rear, beyond the gate, center door. A receptionist is there."
"And I'll be dealing only with you, right?"
"If you wish. Although any officer..."
"Look, mister," exclaimed the ugly American. "We're talking about over 4 million francs.
"Only with me, Monsieur Bourne."
"Fine. Good." Jason put his fingers on the cradle bar. He had 15 seconds to go. "Look, it's 2:35 now." He pressed down twice on the lever, interrupting the line but not disconnecting it. "Hello? Hello?"
"I am here, monsieur."
"Damn phones. Listen, I'll..." He pressed down again, now 3 times in rapid succession. "Hello. Hello.
Monsieur, please, if you'll give me your telephone number.
Operator? Operator!
Monsieur Bourne, please.
I can't hear you.
4 seconds, 3 seconds, 2 seconds.
Wait a minute. I'll call you back. He held the lever down, breaking the connection. 3 more seconds elapsed and the phone rang. He picked it up.
His name's Damacour. Office on the main floor, rear, center door.
I've got it,
said Marie, hanging up. Bourne dialed the bank again, inserted coins again.
Je parlais avec Monsieur Damacour quand dans ma coupé.
Je regrette, monsieur.
Monsieur Bourne? Damacour?
Yes, I'm so terribly sorry you're having such trouble. You were saying about the time.
Oh, yeah. It's a little after 2:30. I'll get there by 3 o'clock.
I look forward to meeting you, monsieur.
Jason re-nodded the phone, letting it hang free, then left the booth and walked quickly through crowds to the shade of a storefront canopy. He turned and waited, his eyes on the bank across the way, remembering another bank in Zurich and the sound of sirens on the Bahnhofstrasse. The next 20 minutes would tell if Marie was right or not. If she was, there would be no sirens on the Rue Madeleine. The slender woman in the wide-brimmed hat that partially covered the side of her face hung up the public phone on the wall to the right of the bank's entrance. She opened her purse, removed a compact, and ostensibly checked her makeup, angling the small mirror first to the left, then to the right. Satisfied, she replaced the compact, closed her purse, and walked past the teller's cages toward the rear of the main floor. She stopped at a counter in the center, picked up a chained ballpoint pen and began writing aimless numbers on a form that had been left on the marble surface. Less than 10 feet away was a small, brass-framed gate, flanked by a low wooden railing that extended the width of the lobby. Beyond the gate and the railing were the desks of the lesser executives, and behind them the desks of the major secretaries, 5 in all, in front of 5 doors in the rear wall. Marie read the name printed in gold script on the center door. M.A.R. Damacour, Vice President, Comte à l'étranger et de visite. It would happen any moment now, if it was going to happen, if she was right. And if she was, she had to know what Monsieur A.R. Damacour looked like. He would be the man Jason could reach. Reach him and talk to him, but not in the bank. It happened. There was a flurry of controlled activity. The secretary at the desk in front of Damacour's office rushed inside with her notepad, emerged 30 seconds later, and picked up the phone. She dialed 3 digits, an inside call, and spoke, reading from her pad. 2 minutes passed. The door of Damacour's office opened, and the vice president stood in the frame, an anxious executive concerned over an unwarranted delay. He was a middle-aged man with a face older than his age, but striving to look younger. His thinning dark hair was singed and brushed to obscure the bald spots. His eyes were encased in small rolls of flesh, attesting to long hours with good wine. Those same eyes were cold, darting eyes, evidence of a demanding man wary of his surroundings. He barked a question to his secretary. She twisted in her chair, doing her best to maintain her composure. Damacour went back inside his office without closing the door, the cage of an angry cat left open. Another minute passed. The secretary kept glancing to her right, looking at something. For something. When she saw it, she exhaled, closing her eyes in relief. From the far left wall, a green light suddenly appeared above 2 panels of dark wood. An elevator was in use. Seconds later, the door opened and an elderly, elegant man walked out carrying a small black case not much larger than his hand. Marie stared at it, experiencing both satisfaction and fear. She had guessed right. The black case had been removed from a confidential file inside a guarded room and signed out by a man beyond reproach or temptation. The elderly figure making his way past the ranks of desks toward Damacour's office. The secretary rose from her chair, greeted the senior executive, and escorted him into Damacour's office. She came out immediately, closing the door behind her. Marie looked at her watch, her eyes on the sweep second hand. She wanted one more fragment of evidence, and it would be hers shortly if she could get beyond the gate with a clear view of the secretary's desk. If it was going to happen, it would happen in moments, the duration brief. She walked to the gate, opening her purse and smiling vacuously at the receptionist, who was speaking into her phone. She mouthed the name Damacour with her lips to the bewildered receptionist, reached down and opened the gate. She moved quickly inside, a determined, if not very bright, client of the Valois Bank.
Pardon, madame?
The receptionist held her hand over the telephone, rushing her words in French.
Can I help you?
Again Marie pronounced the name with her lips. Now a courteous client, late for an appointment and not wishing to be a further burden to a busy employee.
Monsieur Damacour, I'm afraid I'm late. I'll just go see his secretary.
She continued up the aisle toward the secretary's desk.
Please, madame, called out the receptionist. I must announce.
The hum of electric typewriters and subdued conversations drowned out her words. Marie approached the stern-faced secretary, who looked up, as bewildered as the receptionist.
Yes? May I help you?
Monsieur Damacour, please.
I'm afraid he's in conference, madame. Do you have an appointment?
Oh, yes, of course, said Marie, opening her purse again. The secretary looked at the typed schedule on her desk.
I'm afraid I don't have anyone listed for this time period. Oh, my word, exclaimed the confused client of the Valois Bank. I just noticed. It's for tomorrow, not today. I'm so sorry.
She turned and walked rapidly back to the gate. She had seen what she wanted to see, the last fragment of evidence. A single button was lighted on Damacour's telephone. He had bypassed his secretary and was making an outside call. The account belonging to Jason Bourne had specific, confidential instructions attached to it, which were not to be revealed to the account holder. Bourne looked at his watch in the shade of the canopy. It was 2:49. Marie would be back by the telephone at the front of the bank, a pair of eyes inside. The next few minutes would give them the answer. Perhaps she already knew it. He edged his way to the left side of the store window, keeping the bank's entrance in view. A clerk inside smiled at him, reminding him that all attention should be avoided. He pulled out a pack of cigarettes, lit one, and looked at his watch again. 3:08. And then he saw them. Him. Three well-dressed men walking rapidly up Rue Madeleine, talking to each other, their eyes, however, directed straight ahead. They passed the slower pedestrians in front of them, excusing themselves with a courtesy that was not entirely Parisian. Jason concentrated on the man in the middle. It was him. A man named Johann. Signal Johann to go inside. We'll come back for them. A tall, gaunt man wearing gold-rimmed spectacles had said the words in the Stepdeckstrasse. Johann. They had sent him here from Zurich. He had seen Jason Bourne. And that told him something. There were no photographs. The three men reached the entrance. Johann and the man on his right went inside. The third man stayed by the door. Bourne started back to the telephone booth. He would wait 4 minutes and place his last call to Antoine Damacour. He dropped his cigarette outside the booth, crushed it under his foot, and opened the door. Monsieur? A voice came from behind. Jason spun around, holding his breath. A nondescript man with a stubble of a beard pointed at the booth.
Le téléphone? Il ne marche pas. Regardez la corde.
Merci bien. Je vais essayer quand même.
The man shrugged and left. Bourne stepped inside. The 4 minutes were up. He took the coins from his pocket, enough for two calls, and dialed the first.
Le Banque de Valois, bonjour.
10 seconds later, Damacour was on the phone, his voice strained.
Is it you, Monsieur Bourne? I thought you to say you were on your way to my office.
A change of plans, I'm afraid. I'll have to call you tomorrow. Suddenly, through the glass panel of the booth, Jason saw a car swing into a space across the street in front of the bank. The third man, who was standing by the entrance, nodded to the driver. I can do? Damacourt had asked a question.
I beg your pardon?
I asked if there was anything I can do. I have your account. Everything is in readiness for you here.
I'm sure it is, Bourne thought. The ploy was worth a try. Look, I have to get over to London this afternoon. I'm taking one of the shuttle flights, but I'll be back tomorrow. Keep everything with you, all right?
To London, monsieur?
I'll call you tomorrow. I have to find a cab to Orly. He hung up and watched the entrance of the bank. In less than half a minute, Johann and his companion came running out. They spoke to the third man, then all three climbed into the waiting automobile. The killer's escape car was still in the hunt, on its way now to Orly Airport. Jason memorized the number on the license plate, then dialed his second call. If the payphone in the bank was not in use, Marie would pick it up before the ring had barely started. She did.
Yes?
See anything?
A great deal.
Damacour's your man. Chapter 12. They moved about the store, going from counter to counter. Marie, however, remained near the wide front window, keeping a perpetual eye on the entrance of the bank across Rue Madeleine. I picked out two scarves for you, said Bourne.
You shouldn't have. The prices are far too high.
It's almost 4 o'clock. If he hasn't come out by now, he won't until the end of office hours.
Probably not. If he were going to meet someone, he would have done so by now. But we had to know.
Take my word for it. His friends are at Orly, running from shuttle to shuttle. There's no way they can tell whether I'm on one or not, because they don't know what name I'm using.
They'll depend on the man from Zurich to recognize you.
He's looking for a dark-haired man with a limp, not me. Come on, let's go into the bank. You can point out Damacour.
We can't do that, said Marie, shaking her head. The cameras on the ceilings have wide-angle lenses. If they ran the tapes, they could spot you.
A blonde-haired man with glasses?
Or me? I was there. The receptionist or his secretary could identify me.
You're saying it's a regular cabal in there. I doubt it.
They could think up any number of reasons to run the tapes.
Marie stopped. She clutched Jason's arm, her eyes on the bank beyond the window.
There he is. The one in the overcoat with the black velvet collar. Damacour.
Pulling at his sleeves?
Yes.
I've got him. I'll see you back at the hotel.
Be careful. Be very careful.
Pay for the scarves. They're at the counter in the back. Jason left the store, wincing in the sunlight beyond the canopy, looking for a break in the traffic so he could cross the street. There was none. Damacour had turned right and was strolling casually. He was not a man in a rush to meet anyone. Instead, there was the air of a slightly squashed peacock about him. Bourne reached the corner and crossed with the light, falling behind the banker. Damacour stopped at a newsstand to buy an evening paper. Jason held his place in front of a sporting goods shop, then followed as the banker continued down the block. Ahead was a cafe, windows dark, entrance heavy wood, thick hardware on the door. It took no imagination to picture the inside. It was a drinking place for men, and for women brought with men other men would not discuss. It was as good a spot as any for a quiet discussion with Antoine Damacour. Jason walked faster, falling in stride beside the banker. He spoke in the awkward, anglicized French he had used on the phone.
Bonjour, monsieur. Je pense que vous êtes Monsieur Damacour.
I'd say I was right, wouldn't you? The banker stopped. His cold eyes were frightened, remembering. The peacock shriveled further into his tailored overcoat.
Bon?
He whispered. Your friends must be very confused by now. I expect they're racing all over Orly Airport, wondering perhaps if you gave them the wrong information. Perhaps on purpose.
What?
The frightened eyes bulged. Let's go inside here, said Jason, taking Damacour's arm, his grip firm. I think we should have a talk.
I know absolutely nothing. I merely follow the demands of the account. I am not involved.
Sorry. When I first talked to you, you said you wouldn't confirm the sort of bank account I was talking about on the phone. You wouldn't discuss business with someone you didn't know. But 20 minutes later, you said you had everything ready for me. That's confirmation, isn't it? Let's go inside. The cafe was in some ways a miniature version of Zurich's Dry Alpenhauser. The booths were deep, the partitions between them high, and the light dim. From there, however, the appearances veered. The cafe on Rue Madeleine was totally French, carafes of wine replacing steins of beer. Bourne asked for a booth in the corner. The waiter accommodated. "Have a drink," said Jason. "You're going to need it."
"You presume," replied the banker coldly. "I'll have a whiskey."
The drinks came quickly, the brief interim taken up with Damacour nervously extracting a pack of cigarettes from under his form-fitting overcoat. Bourne struck a match, holding it close to the banker's face. Very close.
"Merci."
Damacour inhaled, removed his cigarette, and swallowed half the small glass of whiskey.
"I'm not the man you should talk with," he said.
"Who is?"
"An owner of the bank, perhaps? I don't know, but certainly not me."
"Explain that."
"Arrangements were made. A privately held bank has more flexibility than a publicly owned institution with stockholders."
"How?"
"There's greater latitude, shall we say, with regard to the demands of certain clients and sister banks. Less scrutiny than might be applied to a company listed on the bourse. The Gemeinschaft in Zurich is also a private institution."
"The demands were made by the Gemeinschaft?"
"Requests? Demands? Yes."
"Who owns the Valois?"
"Who?" "Many. A consortium. 10 or 12 men and their families."
"Then I have to talk to you, don't I? I mean, it'd be a little foolish my running all over Paris tracking them down."
"I'm only an executive. An employee."
Damacour swallowed the rest of his drink, crushed out his cigarette, and reached for another. And the matches. "What are the arrangements?"
"I could lose my position, monsieur."
"You could lose your life," said Jason, disturbed that the words came so easily to him.
"I'm not as privileged as you think."
"Nor as ignorant as you'd like me to believe," said Bourne, his eyes wandering over the banker across the table. "Your type's everywhere, Damacour. It's in your clothes, the way you wear your hair, even your walk. You strut too much. A man like you doesn't get to be the vice president of the Valois Bank without asking questions. You cover yourself. You don't make a smelly move unless you can save your own ass. Now tell me what those arrangements were. You're not important to me. Am I being clear?" Damacour struck a match and held it beneath his cigarette while staring at Jason.
"You don't have to threaten me, monsieur. You're a very rich man. Why not pay me?"
The banker smiled nervously.
"You're quite right, incidentally. I did ask a question or two. Paris is not Zurich. A man of my station must have words, if not answers."
Bourne leaned back, revolving his glass, the clicking of the ice cubes obviously annoying Damacour. "Name a reasonable price," he said finally, "and we'll discuss it."
"I'm a reasonable man. Let the decision be based on value, and let it be yours. Bankers the world over are compensated by grateful clients they have advised. I would like to think of you as a client."
"I'm sure you would." Bourne smiled, shaking his head at the man's sheer nerve. "So we slide from bribe to gratuity. Compensation for personal advice and service." Damacour shrugged.
I accept the definition and, if ever asked, would repeat your words.
The arrangements accompanying the transfer of our funds from Zurich was Unfisch confidentiel.
Unfisch, broke in Jason, recalling the moment in Apfel's office at the Gemeinschaft when Koenig came in saying the words.
I heard it once before. What is it?
A dated term, actually. It comes from the middle 19th century when it was a common practice for the great banking houses, primarily the Rothschilds, to keep track of the international flow of money.
Thank you. Now what is it specifically?
Separate sealed instructions to be opened and followed when the account in question is called up.
Called up?
Funds removed or deposited.
Suppose I'd just gone to a teller, presented a bank book and asked for money.
A double asterisk would have appeared on the transaction computer. You would have been sent to me.
I was sent to you anyway. The operator gave me your office.
Irrelevant chance. There are two other officers in the Foreign Services Department. Had you been connected to either one, the fish would have dictated that you still be sent to me. I am the senior executive.
I see. But Bourne was not sure that he did see. There was a gap in the sequence. A space needed filling.
Wait a minute.
You didn't know anything about a fish when you had the account brought to your office.
Why did I ask for it?
Interrupted Damacore, anticipating the question.
Be reasonable, monsieur. Put yourself in my place. A man calls and identifies himself, then says he is talking about over 4 million francs. 4 million. Would you not be anxious to be of service? Bend a rule here and there.
Looking at the seedily elegant banker, Jason realized it was the most unstartling thing he had said. The instructions. What were they?
To begin with, a telephone number. Unlisted, of course. It was to be called. All information relayed.
Do you remember the number?
I make it a point to commit such things to memory.
I'll bet you do. What is it?
I must protect myself, monsieur. How else could you have gotten it? I pose the question, how do you say it? Rhetorically.
Which means you have the answer. How did I get it? If it ever comes up.
In Zurich. You paid a very high price for someone to break not only the strictest regulation on the Bahnhofstrasse, but also the laws of Switzerland.
I've got just the man, said Bourne, the face of Koenig coming into focus. He's already committed the crime.
At the Gemeinschaft? Are you joking?
Not one bit. His name is Koenig. His desk is on the second floor.
I'll remember that.
I'm sure you will. The number? Damacore gave it to him. Jason wrote it on a paper napkin. How do I know this is accurate?
You have a reasonable guarantee. I have not been paid.
Good enough. And as long as value is intrinsic to our discussion, I should tell you that it is the second telephone number. The first was cancelled. Explain that. Damacore leaned forward.
A photostat of the original fiche arrived with accounts courier. It was sealed in a black case, accepted and signed for by the senior keeper of records. The card inside was validated by a partner of the Gemeinschaft, countersigned by the usual Swiss notary. The instructions were simple, quite clear. In all matters pertaining to the account of Jason C. Bourne, a transatlantic call to the United States was to be placed immediately, the details relayed.
Here the card was altered, the number in New York deleted, one in Paris inserted and initialed.
New York?
Interrupted Bourne. How do you know it was New York?
The telephone area code was parenthetically included, spaced in front of the number itself. It remained intact. It was 212. As first vice president foreign services, I place such calls daily. The alteration was pretty sloppy. Possibly. It could have been made in haste or not thoroughly understood. On the other hand, there was no way to delete the body of the instructions without re-notarization. A minor risk considering the number of telephones in New York. At any rate, the substitution gave me the latitude to ask a question or two. Change is a banker's anathema. Damacour sipped what remained of his drink. Care for another? Asked Jason.
No, thank you. It would prolong our discussion.
You're the one who stopped.
I'm thinking, monsieur.
Perhaps you should have in mind a vague figure before I proceed. Bourne studied the man. It could be 5, he said.
5 what?
5 figures.
I shall proceed.
I spoke to a woman.
A woman?
How did you begin?
Truthfully.
I was the vice president of the Valois and was following instructions from the Gemeinschaft in Zurich. What else was there to say? Go on. I said I had been in communication with a man claiming to be Jason Bourne. She asked me how recently, to which I replied a few minutes. She was then most anxious to know the substance of our conversation. It was at this point that I voiced my own concerns. The fiche specifically stated that a call should be made to New York, not Paris. Naturally, she said it was not my concern, and that the change was authorized by signature, and did I care for Zurich to be informed that an officer of the Valois refused to follow the Gemeinschaft instructions?
Hold it, interrupted Jason.
Who was she?
I have no idea.
You mean you were talking all this time, and she didn't tell you? You didn't ask?
That is the nature of the fiche. If a name is proffered, well and good. If it is not, one does not inquire.
You didn't hesitate to ask about the telephone number.
Merely a device. I wanted information.
You transferred 4.5 million francs, a sizable amount, and were therefore a powerful client with, perhaps, more powerful strings attached to him. One box, then agrees, then box again, only to agree again. That is the way one learns things, especially if the party one is talking with displays anxiety. I can assure you, she did.
What did you learn?
That you should be considered a dangerous man.
In what way?
The definition was left open. But the fact that the term was used was enough for me to ask why the Sûreté was not involved. Her reply was extremely interesting. He is beyond the Sûreté, beyond Interpol, she said.
What did that tell you?
That it was a highly complicated matter for any number of possibilities, all best left private. Since our talk began, however, it now tells me something else.
What's that?
That you really should pay me well, for I must be extremely cautious. Those who look for you are also perhaps beyond the Sûreté, beyond Interpol.
We'll get to that.
You told this woman I was on my way to your office?
Within the quarter hour.
She asked me to remain on the telephone for a few moments, that she would be right back. Obviously, she made another call. She returned with her final instructions. You were to be detained in my office until a man came to my secretary, inquiring about a matter from Zurich. And when you left, you were to be identified by a nod or a gesture. There could be no error. The man came, of course, and of course, you never arrived. So he waited by the teller's cages with an associate. When you phoned and said you were on your way to London, I left my office to find the man. My secretary pointed him out, and I told him. The rest, you know.
Didn't it strike you as odd that I had to be identified?
Not so odd as intemperate. A fish is one thing. Telephone calls, faceless communications. But to be involved directly, in the open, as it were, is something else again. I said as much to the woman.
What did she say to you?
Damacour cleared his throat. She made it clear that the party she represented, whose stature was indeed confirmed by the fish itself, would remember my cooperation. You see, I withhold nothing. Apparently, they don't know what you look like.
A man was at the bank who saw me in Zurich.
Then his associates do not trust his eyesight. Or perhaps what he thinks he saw.
Why do you say that?
Merely an observation, monsieur. The woman was insistent. You must understand, I strenuously objected to any overt participation. That is not the nature of the fish. She said there was no photograph of you.
An obvious lie, of course.
Is it?
Naturally.
All passports have photographs. Where is the immigration officer who cannot be bought or duped? 10 seconds in a passport control room, a photograph of a photograph. Arrangements can be made.
No, they committed a serious oversight.
I guess they did.
And you, continued Damacour, just told me something else.
Yes, you really must pay me very well.
What did I just tell you?
That your passport does not identify you as Jason Bourne.
Who are you, monsieur?
Jason did not at first answer. He revolved his glass again.
Someone who may pay you a lot of money, he said.
Entirely sufficient. You are simply a client named Bourne. And I must be cautious.
I want that telephone number in New York. Can you get it for me? There'd be a sizable bonus.
I wish I could. I see no way.
It might be raised from the fish card, under a low-power scope.
When I said it was deleted, monsieur, I did not mean it was crossed out. It was deleted. It was cut out.
Then someone has it in Zurich.
Or it has been destroyed.
Last question, said Jason, anxious now to leave. It concerns you, incidentally. It's the only way you'll get paid.
The question will be tolerated, of course. What is it?
If I showed up at the Valois without calling you, without telling you I was coming, would you be expected to make another telephone call?
Yes. One does not disregard the fish. It emanates from powerful boardrooms. Dismissal would follow.
Then how do we get our money?
Damacour pursed his lips. There is a way. Withdrawal in absentia. Forms filled out, instructions by letter, identification confirmed and authenticated by an established firm of attorneys. I would be powerless to interfere.
You'd still be expected to make the call, though.
It's a matter of timing. Should an attorney with whom the Valois has had numerous dealings call me requesting that I prepare, say, a number of cashier's checks drawn upon a foreign transfer he has ascertained to have been cleared, I would do so. He would state that he was sending over the completed forms, the checks, of course, made out to bearer, not an uncommon practice in these days of excessive taxes. A messenger would arrive with the letter during the most hectic hours of activity, and my secretary, an esteemed, trusted employee of many years, would simply bring in the forms for my countersignature and the letter for my initialing.
No doubt, interrupted Bourne, along with a number of other papers you were to sign.
Exactly. I would then place my call, probably watching the messenger leave with his briefcase as I did so.
You wouldn't, by any remote chance, have in mind the name of a law firm in Paris, would you? Or a specific attorney?
As a matter of fact, one just occurred to me.
How much will he cost?
10,000 francs.
That's expensive.
Not at all. He was a judge on the bench, an honored man.
What about you? Let's refine it.
As I said, I'm reasonable, and the decision should be yours. Since you mentioned 5 figures, let us be consistent with your words.
5 figures, commencing with 5.
50,000 francs.
That's outrageous.
So is whatever you've done, Monsieur Bourne.
Un fiche confidentiel, said Marie, sitting in the chair by the window, the late afternoon sun bouncing off the ornate buildings of the Boulevard Montparnasse outside.
So that's the device they've used.
I can impress you. I know where it comes from. Jason poured a drink from the bottle on the bureau and carried it to the bed. He sat down, facing her. Do you want to hear?
I don't have to, she answered, gazing out the window, preoccupied. I know exactly where it comes from and what it means. It's a shock, that's all.
Why? I thought you expected something like this.
The results, yes. Not the machinery. A fiche is an archaic stab at legitimacy, almost totally restricted to private banks on the continent. American, Canadian, and UK laws forbid its use.
Bourne recalled Damacour's words. He repeated them. It emanates from powerful boardrooms. That's what he said.
He was right.
Marie looked over at him.
Don't you see? I knew that a flag was attached to your account. I assumed that someone had been bribed to forward information. That's not unusual. Bankers aren't in the front ranks for canonization. But this is different. That account in Zurich was established at the very beginning with the fish as part of its activity. Conceivably with your own knowledge.
Treadstone 71, said Jason.
Yes. The owners of the bank had to work in concert with Treadstone. And considering the latitude of your access, it's possible you were aware that they did.
But someone was bribed. Koenig. He substituted one telephone number for another.
He was well paid, I can assure you. He could face 10 years in a Swiss prison.
10? That's pretty stiff.
So are the Swiss laws. He had to be paid a small fortune.
Carlos, said Bourne.
Carlos? Why? What am I to him? I keep asking myself. I say the name over and over and over again. I don't get anything. Nothing at all. Just I don't know. Nothing. But there's something, isn't there?
Marie sat forward.
What is it, Jason? What are you thinking of?
I'm not thinking. I don't know.
Then you're feeling something. What is it?
I don't know. Fear, maybe. Anger, nerves.
I don't know. Concentrate.
God damn it, do you think I'm not? Do you think I haven't? Have you any idea what it's like?
Bourne stiffened, annoyed at his own outburst.
Sorry.
Don't be. Ever. These are the hints, the clues you have to look for. We have to look for. Your doctor friend in Port Noir was right. Things come to you, provoked by other things. As you yourself said, a book of matches, a face, or the front of a restaurant. We've seen it happen. Now, it's a name. A name you avoided for nearly a week while you told me everything that had happened to you during the past 5 months, down to the smallest detail.
yet you never mentioned Carlos. You should have, but you didn't. It does mean something to you. Can't you see that? It's stirring things inside of you. They want to come out.
I know. Jason drank.
Darling, there's a famous bookstore on the Boulevard Saint-Germain that's run by a magazine freak. A whole floor is crammed with back issues of old magazines, thousands of them. He even catalogs subjects, indexes them like a librarian. I'd like to find out if Carlos is in that index. Will you do it?
Bourne was aware of the sharp pain in his chest. It had nothing to do with his wounds. It was fear. She saw it and somehow understood. He felt it and could not understand.
There are back issues of newspapers at the Sorbonne, he said, glancing up at her. One of them put me on cloud nine for a while. Until I thought about it. A lie was exposed. That was the important thing.
But we're not looking for a lie now, are we?
No. We're looking for the truth. Don't be afraid of it, darling. I'm not.
Jason got up. Okay. Saint-Germain's on the schedule. In the meantime, call that fellow at the embassy. Bourne reached into his pocket and took out the paper napkin with the telephone number on it. He had added the numbers of the license plate on the car that had raced away from the bank on Rue Madeleine. Here's the number Damacour gave me. Also the license of that car. See what he can do.
All right.
Marie took the napkin and went to the telephone. A small spiral-hinged notebook was beside it. She flipped through the pages.
Here it is. His name is Denis Corbelier. Peter said he'd call him by noon today, Paris time. And I could rely on him. He was as knowledgeable as any attaché in the embassy.
Peter knows him, doesn't he? He's not just a name from a list.
They were classmates at the University of Toronto.
I can call him from here, can't I?
Sure.
But don't say where you are.
Marie picked up the phone. I'll tell him the same thing I told Peter. That I'm moving from one hotel to another, but don't know which yet.
She got an outside line, then dialed the number of the Canadian embassy on the Avenue Montaigne. 15 seconds later, she was talking with Denis Corbelier, attaché. Marie got to the point of her call almost immediately.
I assume Peter told you I might need some help?
More than that, replied Corbelier. He explained that you were in Zurich. Can't say I understood everything he said, but I've got the general idea. Seems there's a lot of maneuvering in the world of high finance these days.
More than usual. The trouble is no one wants to say who's maneuvering whom. That's my problem.
How can I help?
I have a license and a telephone number, both here in Paris. The telephone's unlisted. It could be awkward if I called.
Give them to me.
She did.
Amare usque ad mare, Corbelier said, reciting the national motto of their country. We have several friends in splendid places. We trade off favors frequently, usually in the narcotics area, but we're all flexible. Why not have lunch with me tomorrow? I'll bring what I can.
I'd like that, but tomorrow's no good. I'm spending the day with an old friend. Perhaps another time.
Peter said I'd be an idiot not to insist. He says you're a terrific lady.
He's a dear, and so are you. I'll call you tomorrow afternoon.
Fine. I'll go to work on these.
Talk to you tomorrow, and thanks again.
Marie hung up and looked at her watch.
I'm to call Peter in 3 hours. Don't let me forget.
You really think he'll have something so soon?
He does. He started last night by calling Washington. It's what Corbelier just said. We all trade off. This piece of information here for that one there. A name from our side for one of yours.
Sounds vaguely like betrayal.
The opposite. We're dealing in money, not missiles. Money that's illegally moving around.
outflanking laws that are good for all our interests. Unless you want the sheiks of Araby owning Grumman aircraft. Then we're talking about missiles. After they've left the launching pads.
Strike my objection.
We've got to see Damacor's man first thing in the morning. Figure out what you want to withdraw.
All of it.
All?
That's right. If you were the directors of Treadstone, what would you do if you learned that 6 million francs were missing from a corporate account?
I see.
Damacor suggested a series of cashier's checks made out to the bearer.
He said that?
Checks? Yes. Something wrong?
There certainly is.
The numbers of those checks could be punched on a fraud tape and sent to banks everywhere. You have to go to a bank to redeem them. Payments would be stopped.
He's a winner, isn't he?
He collects from both sides. What do we do?
Accept half of what he told you. The bearer part. But not checks. Bonds. Bearer bonds of various denominations. They're far more easily brokered.
You've just earned dinner, said Jason, reaching down and touching her face.
I tries to earn my keep, sir,
she replied, holding his hand against her cheek.
First dinner, then Peter, and then a bookstore on Saint-Germain.
A bookstore on Saint-Germain, repeated Bourne, the pain coming to his chest again.
What was it? Why was he so afraid?
They left the restaurant on the Boulevard Raspail and walked to the telephone complex on Rue Vaugirard. There were glass booths against the walls and a huge circular counter in the center of the floor where clerks filled out slips, assigning booths to those placing calls.
The traffic is very light, madame, said the clerk to Marie. Your call should go through in a matter of minutes. Number 12, please.
Thank you.
Booth 12?
Yes, madame. Directly over there.
As they walked across the crowded floor to the booth, Jason held her arm. I know why people use these places, he said. They're 110 times quicker than a hotel phone.
That's only one of the reasons.
They had barely reached the booth and lighted cigarettes when they heard the two short bursts of the bell inside. Marie opened the door and went in, her spiral-hinged notebook and a pencil in her hand. She picked up the receiver. 60 seconds later, Bourne watched in astonishment as she stared at the wall, the blood draining from her face, her skin chalk white. She began shouting and dropped her purse, the contents scattering over the floor of the small booth. The notebook was caught on the ledge, the pencil broken in the grip of her hand. He rushed inside. She was close to collapse.
This is Marie Saint-Jacques in Paris, Lisa. Peter's expecting my call.
Marie.
Oh, my God.
The secretary's voice trailed off, replaced by other voices in the background. Excited voices, muted by a cupped hand over the phone. Then there was a rustle of movement, the phone being given to or taken by another.
Marie.
This is Alan, said the first assistant director of the section. We're all in Peter's office.
What's the matter, Alan? I don't have much time. May I speak to him, please?
There was a moment of silence. I wish I could make